Good morning. Welcome into the 9 to 10 show for this Friday, the 20th day of June. A forensic Friday, which means Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson joins us. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Jack.
Brought to you by Landscaper's Corner at 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. Landscaper's Corner has Triple Crown Elite Grass Seed, the seed everybody's talking about, available in 5, 25, and 50-pound bags. Call 225-9433. Ray, introduce us to our guest, sir.
Well, with us today is Tracy Kinnear, who's been a prosecutor in our office for 17 years.
Wow, really? I didn't realize that.
Well,
long enough to make that picture that's on your website of the stern faces. Stern face picture.
Right.
Yeah.
Mary Houlihan, who is director of our victim services.
Mary, good morning.
And superstar detective Chris Russell.
He's been with us before, Chris.
Yes, he has.
Morning, sir.
And he works with some of the most troubling cases that we ever deal with, and today is one of those cases. In March of last year, 2013, police were called to the Knights Inn Motel, where a 24-year-old victim was found dead. Apparently, the parents, Jerry Lakes and Peggy Whitlock, were loading up their van and leaving the severely emaciated body of their son behind. Now, that's when things started to happen. And what I'd like to do is talk to Chris first. And Chris,
get real close to the mic there, or pull it over. There you go. Good.
So the police come up on a situation like this, and your assignment is to deal with vulnerable adults, among other things. So how does the police process work so that you end up becoming involved in this sort of a case?
Well, when the responding patrol officers found the first victim deceased in the hotel room, they had contacted members of the robbery homicide unit. But a patrol sergeant, Sergeant Daugherty, very good, very heads up move on his part. He observed that they had three other children, and two of which were very, very skinny. And he had contacted me because he was worried about their well-being. He, after having seen the son that had passed away, he contacted me and said he had a couple 12 or 13-year-old boys that looked like they were, in his own words, looked like they had been starved almost to death as well. So when he called, I left and went out to the scene, and although I normally work with adults, what he was describing to me didn't sound like a child, but could easily have been mistaken for one.
What happened that made the police go out there in the first place?
According to the manager of the hotel, Mr. Lakes came into his office that morning and told him that his son was dead in the room they were renting and that they were leaving. And according to the manager, Mr. Lakes' van was outside and everybody was packed in the van.
But he did tell the manager that his son was deceased in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Okay, so why don't you, so you went to the scene in the middle of March last year. Tell us what you found.
When I arrived, the two young men had been moved to another room next door, and when I went in and saw them, I immediately knew them to be adults. I work with individuals with intellectual disabilities quite frequently, and I observed that they both kept trying to stand up. Their mother was in the room with them, and as they would try to stand up, they would fall back down on the bed.
How old did you finally determine that they were?
One was 22 and the other was 20.
Mm-hmm. Falling back on the bed because?
They didn't appear to be able to stand up to me. Each time they would stand up, they would place a hand either on the bed or on some other item. And if the item wasn't stable enough or their legs didn't appear to be stable enough, they would fall back down on the bed.
Was that because of weakness?
It appeared to me to be the case, sir.
Okay,
so go ahead and tell us what you're observed at the scene.
Well, there was an obvious odor coming from both of the boys, and I started taking a really close look, and I observed that one of the young men had some type of growth over top of his teeth, and that they were very, very skinny. They appeared to be starved to me as well. So I started taking a much closer look, and I could tell they had some type of adult diaper on that appeared to be very soiled. And I contacted Adult Protective Services, and two very fantastic workers arrived at the scene. And we began to evaluate.
What were their names? Do you remember?
It was Cliff Bryant and Debbie Miner.
Mm-hmm.
And when they arrived on scene, we began to interview the mother, interview the father about what they had eaten, what they had been doing, how they feed them. Because in the other room, there were some baby bottles found, and they were very, very dirty, had what appeared to be spoiled milk in them. And we didn't find much else that these two could have eaten.
Hmm. So go ahead. Let's talk about, so what about the young, or the person that the father reported was deceased?
And he was still in the other room, and it looked to me and to the homicide detective who came out, they advised they saw the same things.
Was that Christy Smith?
It was Christy Smith, who did a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. She, it appeared that he had been cleaned. So through the investigation, Christy and the other homicide detectives learned that he had died actually several hours prior to this, had been cleaned by his parents. And they had cleaned the room, then loaded all their property up into their van, and it went and told the manager they were leaving.
Had they been living there, I assume?
For approximately 14 days that month and about the same amount of time the previous month.
So they had been there about a month?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And they were living in one room or two rooms?
One room, sir.
Wow. So they got three adult children.
Four.
Four adult children. And the two parents.
Mm-hmm. And the two young men that were alive when you got there but seemed emaciated and seemed that they had special needs, there was a third child?
Yes, sir.
Boy, tell us about the third child.
She was a 19-year-old female, and she was not emaciated. She was able to provide for some of her own basic needs. She was able to feed herself and do some of her own basic activities of daily living.
But she had disabilities also.
Yes, sir. She had a low IQ, suffered from an intellectual disability.
Yes.
Just not as severe as her brothers.
So, Paul, take us through a little bit of the investigation.
Well, when Adult Protective Services arrived and we had interviewed the parents and they were telling us what all that the children were eating, it just didn't seem like that could possibly be the case. So, based on what we observed and based on a conversation with the parents, we contacted EMS, and they transported both to UK Hospital.
You mean both of the 20-year-old and the 22-year-old? Okay. So what about the young, the fellow in the other room that had just been deceased? Would that turn into a homicide investigation?
Absolutely, and Detective Smith was the lead on that and did fantastic. It turned out that I believe his cause of death was related to not being fed properly and not being cared for. The parents advised he had had a number of seizures, but Detective Smith, I believe, uncovered in her investigation that he had not been receiving his medications appropriately either.
Where were these people from?
They had lived in multiple different states. They had lived in Texas. They had lived in eastern Kentucky at multiple different times. The last residence was in Frankfort, and that house had been foreclosed on. They had a very small mortgage on the house every month, and it had been foreclosed. Earlier in the year, we pulled bank records and pulled records from the utilities and found out that the gas, water, electricity had been turned off at various times throughout the winter. And one interesting point, the house had went from approximately 1,400 to 1,500 gallons of water usage a month to over 9,000 to 15,000 gallons. The water company believed at that time that there was a busted water pipe inside the house as well, but they couldn't they couldn't verify that.
Had they paid their rent at the Knights Inn?
They had paid for February, and they were paid up for another couple of days after we were there.
So tell me about your investigation revealed that they were receiving Social Security insurance benefits. Is that?
Yes, sir. Total, the family was getting, I believe the number was $3,986 per month, mm-hmm. cash.
And were you able to determine what that money was being spent on?
As the money would come into the bank, Mr. Lakes would take it all out in cash at one time. Mm-hmm. So he advised it was being spent on various items, food, rent, those sort of things. But we were able to show through records that it was not being spent on a regular basis on electricity, water, or gas, and that it was not being spent on the mortgage as it was not paid for some months mm-hmm. prior to that.
Going to take a break. 26 after 9, News Talk 590 WVLK. And a very disturbing case we're talking about this morning. And, of course, Ray Larson is with us, Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Tracy Kinnear, and Detective Chris Russell, and one of our faves, Mary Houlihan, from the Victims Advocate, part of the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, also with us this morning. Ray?
Okay, Chris, we were talking about where this almost $4,000 a month money was. You've told us where it wasn't going, and that was for living. Were you ever able to determine where that money was being spent?
We determined that a large portion of it was most likely going to some gambling. The first day when we originally interviewed Mr. Lakes, I asked him where the money was going, and just off the cuff, he said, "Well, I'm probably gambling it all away," and then he kind of laughed. So I asked him what that meant and where he might be gambling, and we went into a whole lot of discussion on that. And in subsequent interviews, at one time he told me the exact mileage down to the tenth of a mile to one of the gambling boats from his house in Frankfort. I thought this
was that in Indiana, or where was it?
It was one of the ones in Indiana, sir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so in the course of the investigation, did you and Detective Christy Smith investigate about whether or not you could prove that he was there?
We did, sir, and it turns out that the casinos, they very frequently issue cards kind of like Kroger, a frequent visitor's card, and we found that there was a card in Jerry Lake's name and also one in his daughter's name, and it listed some of the activity. The records were not incredibly accurate, but it did show that they had been there quite a few times in the last few years gambling, and that they had put quite a bit of money into the machine. The records don't necessarily show how much you get back out or how much you win. The casino was more interested in how much they got from you.
Mm-hmm. It's almost always more than they give you, I can tell you that.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Okay, so at a certain point, Tracy Kinnear, a prosecutor in our office that deals with the prosecution of vulnerable adults, got involved. Tracy, why don't you tell us what your role in this was and the process you went through?
Okay. Well, I was contacted by Detective Russell pretty early on because we worked together every month with the Elder Abuse Task Force. So when cases like this come up, Chris is great about calling me and giving me a heads up. So
what is the Elder Abuse Task Force?
The Elder Abuse Task Force is a multidisciplinary team that involves everybody from prosecution and law enforcement, as well as social services, adult protective services, and guardianship. And that way we can have a collaborative effort to review cases to deem whether or not they're prosecutable, or whether or not they just truly have a social aspect.
And these were younger boys. They weren't elderly, but it's still covered under that same group?
That's correct. The 209 statute deals with anybody who is physically or mentally dysfunctioning and unable to care for themselves over the age of 18. So these victims certainly fit that category because they had severe disabilities. Mm-hmm. We believe have what is known as the Fragile X syndrome, and so they were basically mute. They were unable to do really anything for themselves, and especially when not cared for properly the way they had not been. And we'll get to in a minute ago how they have thrived since getting better care. Unfortunately, it was just too late for the oldest one. So Chris got me involved, worked with Detective Smith on the homicide aspect of it, worked with Detective Russell on the neglect aspect of it, and then also worked with the Social Security investigator, Philip Krager, on the financial aspect of it, because that became a big factor as well.
We'll continue in a moment. 253-50. It is 23:10, News Talk 590, WVLK. We have turned out to be a murder case, right? Is that right?
Yeah. It turned out to be a homicide
case. Right. Define that, how that works.
Well, Tracy, talk to us about that.
Well, Jack, in this particular case, it was originally charged as murder, wanton murder. But ultimately, when it was presented to the grand jury ended up indicting it as manslaughter second, which is still under a wanton theory. But I think there was a lot of, unfortunately, sympathy for the parents because they were rather pathetic themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But not so pathetic. I mean, they were healthy. They were eating while their older son died, and the two that were living were weighing 66 pounds and 92 pounds, not receiving medical care. Mr. Lakes himself went to the doctor 47 times in the past 2 years for things as minor as fatigue. So they were able to take care of themselves just fine, but they just flat out chose not to take care of their children.
Chris, tell us the condition the boys were in, the two boys that survived this nightmare when they were taken to the hospital, because in a little bit we're going to tell you how they're doing now.
Yes, sir. When we arrived at the hospital started providing care, and we could actually see what they look like. And the only thing I could use to describe it on the phone to my boss and to Tracy was the pictures of victims in a concentration camp that I saw in school, and they were very bad. Both were missing teeth. One had something growing on the outside of his teeth, bones very visible through the skin. You could see large bumps where his spine was sticking out the back, filth on their bodies, under their fingernails, toes, and neither could stand on a scale to be weighed. We had to actually have a firefighter who was in the ER working an internship stand on the scale, be weighed, and
pick
then hold each one on the scale. They couldn't stand by themselves.
We had a caller that didn't want to go on the air but wanted me to ask if you have any more information on what causes children to develop Fragile X syndrome. Did you know?
I believe in this case what we found was that it was a genetic disorder, but something carried by the father.
I see.
I would like to ask Mary, who is the director of our victim services. So what is your role in this sort of a case, Mary? How do you deal with what Chris found and Christy Smith found in this case from a victim services standpoint?
Well, interestingly, with a case like this, I've actually never met the victims themselves because there's nothing for me to bring to the table in regard to additional interaction with them. What I can do as the victim advocate in this case is make sure that once the case is sentenced, victims have the opportunity to provide to the judge what's called a victim impact statement. Well, clearly, even though these children slash adults have improved, they have not, they don't have that ability to relay to the judge or to really be brought into what happened to their parents in that way. So what I did was coordinate a response from some of the people that were originally involved, in this case the excellent APS workers, Debbie Miner and Cliff Bryant.
What's APS?
APS is Adult Protective Services. Okay. And so they were willing to step up and write statements in regard to what they experienced in coming forward and the improvement that these victims have gone through, so that we could paint a better picture for the judge and include some of the pictures that do look like concentration camp pictures, so that the judge could realize beyond what it sounds like that they are pleading guilty to what really happened to these victims. And the coordination of that comes from the Elder Abuse Task Force that Tracy was talking about. It involves agencies that are working for the protection of the elderly and vulnerable adults in our community. And so we've been discussing this case in an ongoing way so that we could follow the improvement of these victims, but also so that everybody that's connected and concerned can get a feel for the difference we can make when we work together as agencies to speak up for these victims that can't speak for themselves.
One of the I want to quickly get through the charging process and ultimately the guilty pleas. Then I want to spend some time talking about the pretty massive effort to get these young adults placed and have Chris and Mary talk about how they're doing now. So, Tracy, walk us through that quickly.
Okay. Well, as I said, the grand jury indicted on manslaughter in the second degree, as well as criminal neglect for the two living sons, financial exploitation for all three, and theft by deception because the funds were coming from the Social Security Administration and not being used for the appropriate purposes. Unfortunately, all of those crimes, as horrific as the reality is, are C felonies. So the maximum on any of them is 10 years. So ultimately, when they pled guilty, Mr. Lakes did what we call an open plea. We don't negotiate homicide cases, but we can't stop him from pleading guilty without a recommendation. So he entered an open plea, which enables the judge to sit his sentence. He pled guilty across the board to every one of those charges. But under Kentucky law, C felonies can only stack for a maximum of 20 years. The judge
you can have 10 of them, but 20 is going to
right.
be the
maximum. Okay. So we have multiple charges that could have added up to 50 years.
Yeah.
And actually, Judge Scorsone wanted to give him 50 years. But the law will only allow those felonies to stack for a maximum of 20. And then Ms. Whitlock pled to two counts of neglect, and she got 10 years.
Now, once again, this leads me to one of my favorite topics, and that's the stupidity of some of our laws. Mm-hmm. And manslaughter in the second degree, in this case, is considered by our legislature as a nonviolent crime. Mm. And as a result, he gets 20 years, and he's eligible to be paroled after serving 20% of that. So he really, in 4 years, he's going to be eligible for parole because the crimes that he was convicted of are perceived to be nonviolent for some reason. So, any rate, that's where we were in on the sentencing. But the story continues, and that is more, in my opinion, more importantly, what's happening with these young adults, Chris. So, talk about the process you all had to go through to get these youngsters located in some sort of facility that's going to help them.
Absolutely. The original day we were at the hospital, Cliff Bryant and Debbie left immediately and went and filed for guardianship. And guardianship was granted a few days later. And both
explain that what that means.
They went before the judge. They filed a petition in court and went before the trial commissioner of the Mental Health Division of District Court, and he gave the state custody of these two dependent adults. They were then placed, they were actually at the hospital for another 2 to 3 weeks. Then they were placed in a support for community living home. It's a home for persons with an intellectual disability who were diagnosed with an IQ of less than 70 prior to the age of 18. And we kept up with them over the months because we were charging neglect. We were trying to prove somebody had not done something.
Mm-hmm.
So after multiple conversations with Tracy, we determined the best way to do that was to show that when someone else is doing it, how they recover. And in very short order, John and Tom, or the victims, began to put on massive amounts of weight for their own size, and you know, within just a few months, we're 16 and 20% above their weight the day at the hospital.
Wow. And you said, you told me in a break that you went to see them not too long ago. Tell us what you saw.
Sure. We, multiple times throughout the investigation, we went to their current group home and took pictures of them and interacted with them to see how they were recovering and to document that. And one of the last times we were there, one of the boys who was unable to stand at the hospital had decided he wanted to go outside and play basketball, so he took off running down the hallway.
That's phenomenal.
And it was, you know, it was great to see him able to walk by himself.
Oh, that's so good. Have they gotten dental care and that sort of thing, too?
I have seen recent pictures, and both they can actually smile, and they were smiling in the pictures, and they had very nice teeth.
We're taking a break. We'll be right back. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. Have about 3 minutes remaining in the program, Ray, so I'll let you take over there, sir.
Okay, Chris. You know, police and prosecutors deal with these horrible cases, and I'm frequently asked by folks, how do you do that? And how do you deal with this kind of a case?
This case was unique, sir. I frequently am climbing through houses with 6 feet of trash and garbage in them to gain evidence, but this case was a little different. You know, it involved two living boys that were almost not anymore. And I think the satisfaction and the knowing that you are never going to change the world, but we've changed these two boys' lives forever.
Saved their lives is what you did.
Very possibly, sir. Yeah. But they will always have a better quality of life than they ever had before. And to see them recover and to see them do well is really how you get through things like this. It's really how you deal with them.
You know what I'm taking away from all this? How could this have happened with nobody noticing? How could this have – people saw this happening. Somebody saw it happening and decided to stay quiet about it. And that's what really upsets me, that something could have been done and maybe saved that other boy's life if somebody had just picked up the phone and said – I'm seeing something here that doesn't look right to me.
Well, we're always asking people to get involved and pay attention and report it. And, Mary, what can people do?
Well, when you see something like this, if you have those concerns, it's not a matter of you needing to know for sure what's going on, but you can call 859-245-5258 to report this kind of concern or abuse. When you see it, report it. And it's just so important what you just said, Jack, because that's exactly it. They're vulnerable adults because there's not going to be an automatic person that's seeing them that knows exactly how they're being taken care of or what their issues are. And basically some of the concerns that we ended up finding out about these victims were hidden by the fact that they did definitely have significant challenges that they were really mm-hmm. facing. But their parents added to that to their own peril.
All right. I appreciate, Chris, I appreciate the work you do, sir. I don't know how you do it, but...
In my opinion, he's Lexington's finest resource.
Yeah. I don't know how you do it, seriously, but thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And Tracy, you do great work, and of course, we all know that Mary's one of my faves, and Ray, thank you, sir. I will see you guys in 2 weeks.
Okay.
Stand by.